has the mob, right-wing representations of Hegel, from Schelling to Alex Jones. A specter is haunting conspiracy theorists worldwide. The specter of Hegel. All the powers of the anti-New World Order, far right, have entered into an alliance to exorcise this unholy specter. Alex Jones, David Icke, Ron Paul supporters, libertarian punk rockers, neo-Nazis, and my favorite, Christian fundamentalists. Two things result from these facts. That one, the dialectic is acknowledged by these groups to be the philosophical and theoretical basis of liberalism, socialism, communism, and everything else unholy and evil. And two, that it is high time Marxists should come to grips as to why Hegel and Hegelian dialectics are being consistently targeted by the far right and by conservatives historically, from the later Schelling to Alex Jones's prison planet. However, before we start tracing our short history of anti-Hegelianism, we acknowledge that current anti-Hegelian biases on the American far right are largely ignorant of what Hegel actually wrote or said. The Hegelian dialectic, as it is featured, for instance, in the rants of the Alex Jones show, has very little explicitly to do with Hegel's actual dialectic. However, there is, as Marx would put it, a rational kernel of truth about Hegel in these very benighted diatribes against a seemingly obscure German philosopher from the 19th century. We want to demonstrate below how such ill-informed invectives against Hegel have continuity with opponents of Hegel that were indeed much more well-informed and more read about his philosophy and what they considered its inherently subversive nature. In extracting this rational kernel, we want to make a detour through the more highbrow 19th century reactions towards the lowbrow, limited political epistemologies of 21st century conspiracy theorists. Starting with Schopenhauer, we see for the first time in his criticisms a connection made between Hegel's philosophy and what Schopenhauer calls plebeian elements. For Schopenhauer, Hegel's philosophy of history is contaminated by too much of a concern with labor and practical activity. And even before Hegel, Schopenhauer notices a low or base element in classic German philosophy in general. Kant, Fichte, and Hegel all confuse, for Schopenhauer, an essential distinction between culture and work. And the gaze of these philosophers is illegitimately directed towards establishing social and political conditions for work at the expense of culture. In other words, their gaze was directed towards worldly cares of how to earn a living for oneself and one's family, and not exclusively on proper philosophical pursuits. Such pursuits for Schopenhauer were properly reserved for independently wealthy gentlemen of leisure, free of the burdens of middle-class society. For Schopenhauer, the distinction between culture and work collapses among intellectuals who had to work for a living. Kant, Fichte, and Hegel all had to endure humiliations and limitations as tutors for wealthier German families. These tutors reflected on their experiences and developed a resentment against their aristocratic employers, posing a conflict between the objective educational needs of the aristocrats' children and the arbitrary whims of those same aristocrats. This stress on public education, in contrast to the flaws of the family, was stressed by the German idealists in order to break the arrogance of the old society. Thus, behind the ostensibly servile nature of German philosophy to the state, for Schopenhauer, such a philosophy actually aimed at fundamentally uprooting social relations to better to better conform, excuse me, with what Schopenhauer considered to be abstract notions. So Schopenhauer perceives the new threat to society this German philosophy represents, of a drive to replace traditional aristocracies with what he calls a dictatorship of scholars. Such a triumph brings in its wake for Schopenhauer the coming to power of, quote, the more abject class, or the scum of society, or those starving scholars who earn their living by means of a false, deceitful literature, unquote. Intellectual life is no longer preserved for the wealthy gentleman elite. In fact, it has become a job marked by plebeian baseness. Hegel, more than anyone else for Schopenhauer, represents this disease of modern life. And indeed, Hegel isn't even a proper idealist for Schopenhauer, but a vulgar realist. After radicalizing Kant, Schopenhauer made an even sharper distinction between essence and appearance, or truth in the phenomenal world, making the two impossible to coincide conceptually or historically. But since Hegel's philosophy of history is also a philosophy of actuality, Hegel necessarily must confuse for Schopenhauer appearance for essence, since what is real is rational for Hegel, and what is rational is real. With this vulgar conception of reality, not only does Hegel become a worshiper of the established fact, he also becomes, quote, an optimist and a eudaimonist, focusing on constitutions and legislations, along with the steam engine and telegraph, unquote, to improve mankind. For Schopenhauer, politics and science are so many forms of appearance, and Hegel is guilty of degrading philosophy into a, quote, most shallow, philistine, vulgar attitude that abandons noble, elevated thoughts. Hegel's philosophy thus degrades the intellectual from a gentleman scholar into something more reformist and power-hungry. So after the death of his father, Frederick Wilhelm III, the Prussian king Frederick Wilhelm IV sought to exorcise the Hegelianism from Berlin with the help of Hegel's old friend turned reactionary, Friedrich Wilhelm Schelling. The king wanted Schelling to root out what he called the dragon seed of Hegelian philosophy, and Schopenhauer himself called it an intellectual STD, that turned so many young students crazy with left-wing ideas. What Restoration ideology needed was a philosophical defense against this kind of rationalism, and Schelling was contracted by the court in Berlin to lecture against his one-time friend and partner in German idealism. Now, the late Schelling may not have been so pessimistic as Schopenhauer was about the world, but he was pessimistic in his later thought about the ability of philosophy to know the world. And without the ability to know, there isn't much of a reason to change it. Schelling drew a sharp distinction for what he called a negative philosophy that could establish things a priori according to reason, and a positive philosophy, which he agrees with, which grasps the world as it is in an extra-logical way. This extra-logical dimension made possible Schelling's late Christian philosophy of revelation, or what he coined for the first time as existentialist philosophy. That was Schelling's term. According to Engels, in an early polemic he wrote against Schelling after attending his lectures, such a positive philosophy made it possible to smuggle, quote, into the liberal science of thought a faith in authority, emotional mysticism, and Gnostic fantasizing. Schelling did acknowledge in his polemic against Hegel that the political radicalism and atheism of the young Hegelians was a necessary consequence of Hegel's dialectical method. The method describes a process where the potentiality of God is actualized in the designs of, quote, ill-informed and otherwise perhaps unreliable men, unquote. This results, for Schelling, from the confusion of positive with negative philosophy, which is the main cause of the new radicalism, quote, therein lies the ground of confusion and the wild, disorderly state into which men fell by first attempting to present God as involved in a necessary process. But thereafter, when they could go no further, they took refuge in downright atheism. Hegel's ideas for Schelling had thus lost currency for the more highly educated classes in Frederick Wilhelm IV's bureaucracy, and subsided in the, quote, meantime, into the deeper strata of society that still remain themselves base. Unquote. Now, there were a few notable figures in attendance at Schelling's lectures against Hegel in Berlin in 1841. Two of them, Mikhail Bakunin and Frederick Engels, walked away in contempt and reaffirmed their respective commitments to Hegelianism, materialism, and socialism. The other figure present, Søren Kierkegaard, was also severely disappointed by Schelling's performance, but in a different way. Instead of rejecting the new philosophical viewpoint of Schelling's existentialist philosophy, he sought to radicalize it further. Kierkegaard had a much deeper knowledge and appreciation of the left-wing consequences of Hegel's ideas, in contrast to the late Schelling, and he was particularly familiar with the writings of Ludwig Feuerbach, whom he respected as a philosophical adversary. Now, like Schopenhauer and Schelling, Kierkegaard rejected Hegel's rationalism, but because it degraded the unique individual before the rational whole. Hegel's philosophy for Kierkegaard was what he called a, quote-unquote, dissolute pantheism that destroyed authentic faith in Christ. Faith in Christ had to be a unique emotional and individual experience that did not need demonstration or proof. Indeed, such demonstration or rationalistic attempts to secularize religiosity could only do violence to authentic Christianity. To believe in God for Kierkegaard was to believe not because it made sense, but because it was absurd. So Hegel's dissolute pantheism also had concrete social and political effects for Kierkegaard. If one man is able to understand God rationally as a concept, then he becomes identical with him, betraying his own individual and finite status. And this creates a certain level of arrogance in man, and it degenerates into a multitude of men thinking that they are part of God as well. From Kierkegaard's Sickness Unto Death, we read, "The doctrine of the God-man, or the doctrine that men are identical with God, has sunk so low that the mob is now considered to be God. The philosophers, like Hegel, forget that after all this was their doctrine, and they overlook the fact that it was not more true when the superior men accepted, the professors in Berlin, or when the elite of the superior class or elect circle of philosophers was the incarnation, that it had these social consequences." So this railing against God as the mob, or God becoming humanity, is connected to Kierkegaard's own aristocratic politics and his staunch defense of monarchism. For Kierkegaard, there is an intimate link between Hegelianism and the emerging socialist movement in the Europe of the 1840s. But it was Satan, and not God for Kierkegaard, that was present among the millions of workers and protesters who struggled in 1848. As Kierkegaard put it, quote, "God is present here in the Copenhagen protests, only in a very confused fashion, or perhaps not at all. Perhaps it is rather the devil. A mediocre ruler is a much better constitution than this abstraction of 100,000 grumbling non-humans." Unquote. The solution to such growing unrest on the continent for Kierkegaard was not a people's government, call that an image worse than hell, but a more authentic anti-Hegelian and anti-rationalist religiosity. It was up to Christian VIII, the Danish monarch, to lead his people away from socialism by emphasizing what Kierkegaard would call a proper upbringing. The disease of Hegelianism became more prominent in the minds of liberal and conservative intellectuals during the 1848 revolutions in France, Germany, and elsewhere. Alexis de Tocqueville, in his correspondence, posed the problem in the sharpest and most conspiratorial light by claiming that Hegel's philosophy originated, quote, in all the anti-Christian and anti-spiritualistic schools that have tried to corrupt Germany and also the socialist school that favored the 1848 disorders, unquote. The essence of Hegelianism, indeed, for Tocqueville was materialist and socialist and sensualist because it was concerned with the well-being of the masses instead of Tocqueville's aristocratic conception of liberty. But Hegel is not only condemned by Tocqueville for crypto-materialism. In libertarian fashion, Hegel is also criticized for being, quote, the protege of governments, since the political consequences of his doctrine established that all events were respectable and legitimate, and that they deserved obedience for the very fact that they had produced themselves. For Tocqueville, Hegel's idealism of the actuality, or what he considers as the accomplished fact of the world, will also legitimate statist and bureaucratic socialism. But however, it is important to note how Tocqueville only condemns egalitarian statism, and not the form of statism needed to hinder and subdue popular movements, the popular movements of 1848. Against those, Tocqueville sided with the party of order. The clear connection drawn by Tocqueville between Hegel and socialism is reinforced by Friedrich Nietzsche in his early notebooks. Now, Tocqueville anticipates Nietzsche's concerns with the rise of a herd-like civilization and shares many of his aristocratic sensibilities and positions. Also, like Tocqueville, Nietzsche unearths what he calls a secret of Hegel's philosophy as the collectivism of the masses or socialism. In writing in the wake of the Paris Commune, Nietzsche's philosophical efforts included attacking the conceptual and theoretical foundations of socialist thought, with dialectical philosophy as one of its pillars. For Nietzsche, dialectical thinking is already rabble-like thinking, and he traces a trajectory from ancient dialectics to the Paris Commune in his first book, The Birth of Tragedy. But in his later work, he is clearer about this link between the Socratic dialectic and the rule of the rabble in his chapter on Socrates in Twilight of the Idols. This is the sketch Nietzsche offers of the dialectic as a tool for the democratic rabble to dominate. Quote, is the dialectical irony of Socrates an expression of revolt or plebeian resentment? Does he, as one of the oppressed, enjoy his own ferocity and the knife thrusts of his argument? Does he avenge himself on the noble audience he fascinates? As a dialectician, Socrates holds a merciless tool in his hand. He can become a tyrant by means of it. He compromises those he conquers. The dialectician leaves it to his opponent to prove that he is not an idiot. He enrages and neutralizes his opponent at the same time. The dialectician renders the intellect of his opponent powerless. Now, unquote. Moving ahead in Nietzsche to Hegel, it is difficult to pinpoint what Nietzsche's specific relationship is to him in terms of his overall work. On occasion, especially in his later work, Nietzsche posits an affinity between his philosophy of becoming and Nietzsche's own dialectic. However, like all the other intellectuals we discussed, Nietzsche sees a political consequence emanating from the secret of Hegel's philosophy, and that secret is the rule of the masses. From Nietzsche's 1873 notebooks, he writes that Hegel's philosophy sets an aim for world history, with its goal as humanity itself coming to power. But humanity, for Nietzsche, is composed of so many blanks, or non-entities. Quote, it makes no sense at all to preserve so many wretched human beings. The history of Hegel's doctrine of state is the history of the egoism of the masses and of their blind desire to exist. Unquote. The only real history Nietzsche sees is the struggle of the collective egoism of the masses against what he calls genius. But in Hegel, history ends in what Nietzsche labels communism, a term he uses to describe the expression of modern standardization and leveling of culture and classes. Now, in summarizing the positions of these 19th century critics, we observe a strain of what can be called a conservative anti-intellectual intellectualism, or a rejection of the abstract in favor of the immediately concrete and the particular. Hegel's metaphysics was an absolute scandal to these thinkers because of its emphasis on universal reason, totality, and a positive conception of freedom. Now, Marx understood this reaction well against Hegel in his 1873 afterword to Capital. And he writes, quote, "In its mystified form, dialectic became the fashion in Germany because it seemed to transfigure and to glorify the existing state of things. But in its rational form, it is a scandal and an abomination to the bourgeoisie and its doctrinaire professors because it includes in its comprehension an affirmative recognition of the existing state of things at the same time also the recognition of the negation of that state. In its essence, it is critical and it is revolutionary." Now likewise, contemporary libertarians and far-right conspiracy theorists consider Hegel's dialectic an absolute scandal as well. The website's blog shows and presentations of Alex Jones and David Icke cite what they call the Hegelian dialectic as the science of who they consider as the Illuminati and the philosophical foundation of what they consider as the New World Order. Hegel himself is called out as the mastermind behind all totalitarian thinking and the godfather of communism, liberalism, fascism, and every other ism that signifies tyranny and the conservative mind. But specifically, Jones, Icke, and their far-right ilk, which includes some neo-Nazis that swarm their links and pages, see the Hegelian dialectic as a weapon or a science of control used by shadowy elites that leads us directly towards world government. The Hegelian dialectic as the science of manipulation permeates every aspect of modern life for these conspiracy theorists. Its influence is found in music, movies, and television. And even Alex Jones recently cited Bane, the villain from Christopher Nolan's latest Batman film, as an agent of the Hegelian dialectic. Quote, "Who is Bane? He's a symbolic demon, a destroyer, a symbol of the Hegelian dialectic of imposing order out of chaos." Unquote. If one simply plugs into YouTube or Google the phrase Hegelian dialectic, chances are one will run into a video or a website that has little to do with what Hegel wrote, and with his name frequently spelled wrong, and more to do with the formula David Icke invented called problem-reaction-solution. For Icke, Hegel's dialectic works in three stages. First, the secret elite create a problem, i.e. some false flag situation, staging terrorist attacks like 9/11, economic meltdowns, or using MK-Ultra agents to shoot up schools. Second, this problem that the shadowy elites manufacture and create generates a reaction of mass fear and anxiety in the general population. And finally, by exploiting people's fears and anxieties, the shadowy elite can more easily impose their will. For example, for gun control, more taxes, regulation, and of course, the ultimate goal of one world government. Now, of course, anyone who has read a few pages of Hegel will think this is totally off the wall, but for even those conservative and aristocratic philosophers of the 19th century who read Hegel, or in Schelling's case, intimately knew Hegel, there are strong parallels and continuities with the more lowbrow conspiracy theories. First, there is a deep resentment against intellectuals as forming a shadowy and conspiratorial elite, using the brainwashed masses as fodder for their abstract utopian plans. Second, there is a strong conspiratorial fear of socialism or communism, or what Icke and Jones essentially mean when they say New World Order. And third, and most important of all, I think on a philosophical level, there is a rejection of abstract reasoning and universal projects in favor of what's particular or concrete or traditional. From all these conservative, aristocratic, or right-wing thinkers, whether they are the most sophisticated Germanic thinkers, or from the gutters of the internet, they all share a unique animosity towards Hegel's metaphysics and his philosophy of history. And behind all the distortion and caricature, there is indeed, as ironic as it is, a rational kernel in all of these misunderstandings of Hegel's philosophy. It is the same rational kernel that Marx wrote about in his 1873 afterword to Capital. Now, for the left today, it's ironic that these conservative and 21st century right-wing internet personalities and shock jocks understand somewhat a little better the Hegelian dimension of socialism. And it is my contention, to conclude, that by working through the right-wing critique of Hegel, we can better understand, through that kind of reactionary detour, the philosophical and intellectual foundations of socialist thought itself. It is important to know not only who your enemy is, but what they understand as the necessary presuppositions of your own worldview that they reject. Thank you. All right, so for our